Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 20th, 2006. Today's session is entitled An Organizing Society, as presented by John Wallace, number WA-JO 2006-04. Let's listen in.
Wallace, it's now Thursday, and it's my fourth day of doing this, and we've changed some players. In fact, we don't have Dawn anymore.
We're in trouble, yeah.
Which is hard to tell. I got some things I want to talk about. In fact, what I'm going to tell you tonight is one of my stories that I put together and told about early 19th century America, and it has to do with corporations, which relates to what Steve's been talking about all week. What I've been talking about so far this week, and we'll talk more about tomorrow morning, is economic development. We know in the world today, there are about 200 different countries, about 25 are developed, and the rest of them are not. That sounds like a majority statement, but really there's an enormous gap between the wealthy countries of the world. My measure of whether you're wealthy or not is whether your per capita income is higher than the state of Mississippi, which has been the poorest country in the United States for about the last 50 years. And that includes about 25 places. And when you go from there, which is now is maybe about $20,000 a year, there's a big drop, and there's not very many countries until you get down to about $11,000 or $12,000, and then most of the countries are way down at the end. So 40% of the world's population lives in India and China, India has a per capita income of about $800, and China about $1,700. In America, it's $44,000 per year. We talk about what income, and we did talk about a little bit about what per capita income means. The larger issue that I want to get at is why are some places developed and other places not? And because if we're interested about helping those who are disadvantaged, the single largest problem is why are some societies developed and others not? Because the developed societies enjoy better political freedoms, they enjoy better human rights, they enjoy better health, they enjoy all kinds of different things. And so there's a question about why societies are unable to do this, and it's very difficult. There are hundreds of millions of dollars spent every year both researching this and attempting to induce development to occur, and it just hasn't happened in lots of places. Argentina, for example, was about as rich as the United States in 1890, and it's continued to go like this. So today, Argentinian income is about an eighth of what it was in the United States today. It'll come back. Argentina has problems where they go back and forth. So for the last 2 days, I've been talking about a way of thinking about how societies are organized. And it starts with the basic idea that human beings before 10,000 years ago, and what we might call hunters and gatherer societies or primitive societies, those societies were extremely violent. And in fact, there's really strong archaeological evidence that hunting and gathering societies are barely violent places. And modern studies show that about 30% of adult males in hunting and gathering societies can expect to die a violent death. A really high percentage. So how do we get around this problem of violence? How do we limit it? Because it's not possible to do it by sort of gathering together and praying. You know, the guy's got a gun. What are you gonna do? And of course, we've been hearing over last night and today about violence. And Ron talking about it. In our society, right? Within families, there's a problem with violence. And so we talked about what I call a natural state or a limited access social order. John Beck is here. He was one of our warlords. Don Johnson was the other. They're gone. And we tried to figure out a way that we could get violence stopped. Hunting and gathering society, everybody's violent, but some people are more violent than others. And John and Don turned out to be very violent people. And the way in which we limited their violence was essentially giving them property rights to everybody else in the room.
And now it's just
John. And he's really excited to be here tonight, folks. Because you know what? He believes tyranny. We got Ron back. All right, Ron. You're the warlord. You're the warlord. Okay, we got Ron.
Warlord.
So what happens is, and I'll talk about this logic, then I realize I'm going to skip through things very quickly, is that if Ron owns this half of the room and John owns this half of the room, and they own everything, and they're the big, powerful guys, so they enforce each other's rights, and we don't have any, okay? Then what happens is, if we're more productive if they're not fighting, the rents, that is the return that they get from us producing more, if they're peaceful, can enable them to promise each other in a credible way not to fight. Okay? So this is not a contract that can be enforced by a third party because they're the only guys. Okay? It has to be self-enforcing so that by creating property rights for them, they can provide a solution to the problem of violence. It doesn't eliminate violence. Ron and John stay heavily armed, and in fact, they repress the rest of us. But they deny us rights. And if I get lucky and I grow more wheat this year, most of it ends up in John's possession. And they, of course, once they do this, the great thing about this is it reduces the level of violence. It doesn't eliminate it. And the second thing is now, since John and Ron have an incentive to make us more productive, they're going to let people trade. Right? But they're not going to have everybody having free trade. Rick's going to get, he'll be the trade minister for John, and Paul will be the trade minister for Ron. And they, too, will have a monopoly on trade. They're going to get rich doing this, and because they're getting rents, they're what economists would call rent, which is a return above your next best alternative. You could be a normal farmer and not very much, or you could be a trader and get twice or double your income. Because you're getting that extra income solely because John and Ron have this agreement, who do you support? John and Ron, right? So that you build a system, if everybody can trade, they get no rents and the system falls apart. So you have to have limited access. You have to like create monopolies. Okay? Create rents is the way economists would say it. And that holds the system together. And what we did over the last 2 days was to look at both the history of kind of states, but particularly of the church, to see how events in the development of the papacy in particular, in the 11th and the 14th century, when in 1075 the popes attempted to sort of exert political control over Europe by denying the right of kings to appoint the bishops, and instead assign that with the pope, that the church, which is clearly a natural state, it's one of these privileged organizations where a relatively small elite have lots of power, actually led to creating laws and institutions to solidify their control of the natural state, okay, of the John Ron element. In fact, they had armies and they were at war, okay? Now, in that limited access society, it's way better than living in a hunting and gathering society. But it will not support modern economic development, modern political development, modern social development, or, let's us not forget, modern religious development, where people get to worship as they please. In a natural state, the priests are typically part of the coalition. So in contrast to a natural state or a limited access order, where only a few people have access to economic activities, and particularly important, only a few people have access to organizations like business firms whose agreements can be enforced by a third party, Ron and John. That is, they have access to courts that will enforce contracts. Most of us don't have that access, and so we cannot form sophisticated organizations like the church. How do we transfer that limited access society to the society that we live in where there's open access? Okay, where anybody who wants to can form a church, and anybody who wants to can form a political party, and anybody who wants to can form a corporation, and the greater society will support those organizations. Everybody can go to court. Everybody can get their agreements enforced. Because people are more productive and they can work in organizations. Bingo. Those societies are way more productive. And guess what? If you look at those 25 rich countries, they all have what we would call rule of law. And you look at the rest of them, and they all have some kind of laws. As Steve's been talking about, what is it? 10 or 12% of the world's population lives in places that doesn't even have law, that they don't even have effective governments. And another maybe 20% live in places that those are very weak. In China, do the laws apply equally to everybody? No, the Communist Party is the only political party. They do not have political competition in China. So the big question, the $64 trillion question, that's even more than that probably, is how do you get from being a society that limits violence by limiting access, by restricting competition, okay, by giving people privileges and using those privileges to create incentives for people to not be violent, to a society in which society is ordered by competition, in which political parties compete and corporations compete and religions compete, right? And we provide order because if anybody tries to get too much power, there's really strong incentives for the rest of us to say, no, we're going to elect another party. We're going to bring in another regime. Now, that's tricky and, in fact, fragile. Okay. So what I wanted to talk about now, what I want to do is shut up for a second. Does anybody have any questions? Because I've given you all in 10 minutes, which has taken 3 hours over the last 3 days.
A question?
Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned about natural state is that a disproportionate amount of the wealth is held by Don and John.
Yeah. And then by Rick and Paul.
And they don't all have equal access to law enforcement, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
It seems like one could argue in the U.S. today that there's a great maldistribution of wealth among people in this country.
You could.
Which looks like a natural state. And that white-collar crime, especially with higher executives, does not follow through with in the same way that, and one could even argue that the religious right is co-opted by political influences on these days.
Yeah.
What differentiates from natural state is not the outcome, but the
process.
Process.
Yeah. Income in the United States, it has become more unequally distributed over the last 20 or 30 years. It's way more equally distributed than it is in Latin America. Okay? The United States is... There are several developed countries that have more equal distributions of income and several that have less equal distributions of income. So the United States is not really way out on the maldistribution end. Okay? The poorer you get, what happens to distribution of income?
There are other developed countries that have worse...
Yeah, they're what we think of as the nicest place to live, Hong Kong, Singapore. There's something called the Kuznets curve, which is that when you're really poor, income is very unequally distributed. As you grow, income tends to be more equally distributed, and then as you get richer, it tends to be less. So there's kind of a U-shaped relationship. But it's not clear. In America, income got more equally distributed in the middle of the 20th century and less equally distributed at the ends. So it's not, if you want a trend, pick a period. You want it to go up, pick one period, you want it to go down. So it's a little bit hard to figure out where it's going on. They're not nearly as unequally distributed as Latin America. Latin America is the most unequally distributed place in the world. Okay. Think of some place, a country like Nigeria, okay, or Kenya, where there's a high concentration of wealth, and then there's some middle class, and then there's a lot of really poor people. In poor countries, the distribution of income tends to be extremely unequal, because a very large percentage of the income and wealth is held by a very small percentage. So, there's ups and downs, and there's clearly differences across developed countries. That the emphasis here is not really on outcomes. I don't want to define a natural state as being poor and an open access society as being rich, mm-hmm. right? I want to define them in terms of the process, the way societies are organized. And the outcome of that is, in fact, in general, development. I'll talk a little bit more about that when we make some explicit comparisons between developed and developing, or non-developed, or third world. Or there's a bunch of terms we can use tomorrow. Okay? Yep.
Down the road.
It could.
Hope it does too.
Yeah. I think there's different times and different forces. So like World War II was the Great Depression and World War II were tremendously equalizing. And they made a bunch of differences that were permanent. Okay? Changes in demography and the location of people and that had a big impact on the distribution of income. And so for a while there's some kind of funny deals here that when it's more equal, fewer people go to college. Right, because part of the equality of the income stream is returns to education. So what's been happening is that the gap between high school education and college education earnings has risen, right, which is leading more people to make a rational choice to go to school. So there's lots of equilibrating factors going on here. And it probably isn't the case that there's a trend. There's a lot of movement up and down. Anthony?
I sometimes like to speculate that to a certain degree I know that in between Republicans and Democrats are looking at certainly different philosophies, one more perhaps socialist, the other capitalist. Maybe not, I don't know, is that wrong?
No, there's differences.
Okay, anyway.
But I'm not sure that the Republican and Democrat spans the possibilities, but yeah.
But I know that the religious right to a certain degree has had a statement. I know that Bush has certainly come forward with
right.
The religious statement in relationship to, if you will, political philosophy, and I'm not sure to a certain degree whether or not there might be a catalyst on the contrary to that, not necessarily anti-religion, but
right.
Perhaps more humanism or
yeah, you bet. In fact, I don't want to get into the details of the modern American economy or polity at the moment, because that's, I really want to talk about things that happened earlier so we can understand what the situation that we're in. If you look at American history, things go all over the map. Okay? I mean, it's not a linear process. Politics is, you know, there's liberals, there's conservatives. There's times when you cannot, in any feasible set, talk about liberals and conservatives. Okay? I mean, that those aren't two alternatives. Those are the alternatives in our life because of what happened with the Democrats and the New Deal. Right? What are the Democrats today? They're certainly not socialists. I don't even know that they're an alternative. You know, because they can't beat a president who's just... I won't say that. Right? I mean, I don't know. So it's hard to say where the political parties are going to go next. The Democrats clearly don't know what to do. Right? They don't have a state. I couldn't tell you what the Democrats stand for anymore. Yeah, and that's why they can't get elected. Right? But they're old. So anyway, I want to stop on this point because we could talk about this all night, obviously. Maybe we should, but not tonight. Because what I want to do, if this is the question about now, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to cut off the conversation, but we need to understand why our system works the way it does, okay, in part. Why it is an open access, and remember the trillion-dollar question is, how do you get from limited access to open access? And these are questions about how does an open access society work? And it's really competitive, which means that we can move all over the place. There's not a good way for an open access society to be. What it means is there's competition in ideas, in politics, in religion, in economics, in education, in the military, right? And there's all kinds of alternatives, and so the way society goes can move all over the place. The principle, however, is that it's competitive and it's open entry, and that's what makes it work.
So how did it look?
Oh, great, that's a good question, but do you have another question?
Oh, I just wanted to know how wealth plays into
us. Oh, well, we're gonna create it. What?
I wonder how wealth plays into it in terms of comparison between what Europe has developed in.
Well, let's go back to that tomorrow, okay? Because I'll talk explicitly about developing countries and developed countries tomorrow, okay? Because developed countries are more wealthy, okay? And that's a simple answer. There really is a big difference there. The question is what creates wealth, okay? And the mechanism here, I'm suggesting, is open access, is a way of organizing society. So now what I want to talk about is how we get there, yep? Yeah.
I feel like that's definitely a question.
Yeah, no, it's really a question because as we talked about yesterday, clearly the United States in the 1800s is not open access for everybody. Well, 20% of the population has been enslaved, their chattel property. You know, 50% can't vote. In fact, every single state, when it comes in 1776, adopts some kind of property restriction on voting. Right? The difference is that in England, it's 5% of the population voting. Right? And there's not enough, it's limited enough that competition can't work. Well, competition doesn't have to be 100% of the population, but it's probably got to be 25 or 30%. Once competition is an incredible solvent, right? Entry changes things. And when a large enough part of the population gets to do that, society begins to change. And what's happened to political access or economic access and entry in the United States over its history? It increased. When did they give the women the vote in Switzerland? 1970. Okay, so there's an opening process that's going on continually, and it's not quite. We're still changing. I'm not at all saying that our society is perfect. Whew, man, I got lots of problems with it. But there's a switch that occurs in the beginning, in sometime in the 18th and 19th century. I want to talk about corporations explicitly tonight, and I don't want you to think that I'm just talking about business corporations, okay? The real key to human productivity is organization. Can people work together? As we talked about a little bit yesterday, there's a problem if we have to have adherent organizations, that if our organizations are purely voluntary, and they have to be voluntary in every second of time, they can't be very strong organizations, because if people have a desire to walk out today and they walk out, the whole organization falls apart. And if we know that people can leave at any moment, we can't make many binding commitments. So strong organizations or sophisticated organizations typically have a third party. We agree to contract, we make promises to each other, which somebody else can be called in to enforce. And that enables us to get bigger organizations. Corporations are a formal recognition by society that a specific group of people, initially in most corporate charters, by name, possess certain rights and privileges to organize. Okay. Steve was involved in writing the rewriting the corporate code for Montana, right? Which is essentially about, it says, if you go to Missoula or Helena or Bozeman, to whatever agency it is that grants corporate charters, then pay your $300 fee, and you have three names, and you're not felons, you can become a body corporate. You can become a legal entity which enjoys certain rights and responsibilities. And depending on how you file and how you pay your taxes, you can sell stock, you can have limited liability. The biggest thing that you get when you do that is perpetual life. Okay, it does. If one of you dies, it doesn't matter. You can bring up the identity of the individuals involved. It's not significant. How many churches in the United States have charters? Virtually all of them. They're all corporations. Holden Village is a corporation. Okay, Augustana is a corporation. Okay, it's a way that society recognizes a group of people as an organization who enjoy certain privileges. Okay, so what I want to talk about is how access to corporate organizational forms developed in the United States. It's both for religious, educational, business. We're going to focus on business because that's the most obvious one. Steve's been focused on business all week long. And, of course, we all believe that corporations are
evil.
I mean, that's the one Socratic question I know I can get the right answer on. Okay, we all believe they're evil, and they're all made up of people like us, right? Okay, they're a boogeyman over there. And sometimes they really are evil, but sometimes they're not. So how do we do that? Our society has about 2 million corporations. Okay, so they're clearly not all the size of Microsoft. And in Peru, it takes you 175 days to get a business license to sell t-shirts. In Washington State, you can get a corporate charter this afternoon. Okay, you can organize, and in lots of different ways. So how did we get there? Okay, as of yesterday, Martin Luther was still alive and pissed and mad at the church, and we were getting a system in which we were separating. Luther is saying, there's the state and here's the church, and the reason we're in trouble is because the law says the Pope is God, and we got to get the church and the state separated a bit. You know, you owe an obligation as a Christian to obey the law and to support the order that you're in. And so as a result of Luther, there's a whole host of things that happen. We call it collectively the Reformation. There's religious developments in a lot of different lines. Okay, there's political developments. There's a counter-revolution, or counter-reformation. There's a whole series of religious wars that are going to go on for the next century and a half. Okay? Part of this religious war business gets tied up with politics in the sense of, is France Catholic or not? Is England Catholic or not? Does the Pope have the right to appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury or not? Right. St. Anselm and his faction lose. Right? They try to argue, no, we have the right to appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury. It's something that we have the right to do. And the Pope ultimately decides, oh no, I'm sorry. We're the primate of England. And the Pope says, no, you know, you're the Archbishop of Canterbury and there's another Archbishop in York. Is equally as powerful with you. So there was debates about this everywhere, and nations are beginning to form. Nations, okay, here I'm John, I'm just John, okay, I'm just the guy. And here, I'm King John, right? The formation of the law is creating an artificial entity called the king, that when I die, this body does not. The state continues on. When the Pope dies, the Pope doesn't die. Because the Pope is not the guy. The Pope is the dignity of the office. The king is dead. Long live the king. The king never dies. Because the corporateness of this guy, as opposed to the corporealness of me, yeah. Right? So corporations, as the word, have been around since Roman times. Okay? There have been organizations that have perpetual life. The question is, how do these guys form? Are there rules under which they form? Is it a Ron, John, Don thing? You know, Ron, Don, John, Carol, Ted, okay? Is the power in Alice that associated with this chair, is it just the result of short-run power plays? Or is it, in fact, a permanent organization with a perpetual life whose life lives on beyond the life of the current entity? The church, in these battles, creates a concept of law that is canon law, that creates a perpetualness, an eternalness about this chair. Were you talking about chairs this morning? And the power that the chair gives you? Right? So here's then the problem. As we begin to get religious warfare and we're trying to decide which churches should be hooked up with which states, the law remains an incredibly important stabilizing force. And the Reformation, as the church had done before, does not suggest that we should overthrow the law. In fact, Luther says, as we talked about yesterday, that the law is very important. You should obey the law. And so in 1561, we get the Russia Company being formed in Britain. Now, Britain is a homogeneous island in some way. What was it? The offshore island. It had a relatively homogeneous population, right? Henry VIII is going to depose the Catholic Church and say, we're going to have an Anglican church. And partly, when he does that, he confiscates the Christus, right? He takes some church lands that belong to the church as a corporate entity and takes them for himself and redefines a new church that the king will be the nominal head of, right? But in fact, there will still be an Archbishop of Canterbury. There's Episcopalians who recognize the primacy of the Archbishop to this day, right? Yeah. And in that process, now you've got a well-defined elite that has seized and reformed the natural state in Britain. And in their interest, they say, we would like to start trading with Russia. But Elizabeth, the queen, says, I want to create a group of people to do that, Rick and Paul. And she gives them privileges. She gives them a monopoly of the right to trade with Russia. And they are called the Russia Company. And the rights that they have are written down in the charter of the Russia Company Corporation. It names the people. They're all aristocrats. They're all members, close members of the king, of the queen's circle of advisors. And they open a trade with Russia, in which they have the monopoly. They are like Rick. Okay, and of course, this Russia company immediately begins to negotiate with the, I was at that time the Tsar. Was there a Tsar in Russia in 1500? Okay, for access to their markets. Okay, how does the first English? Does anybody know what the first permanent English settlement in the United States is? Which is the oldest state? Virginia. The Virginia Company was chartered in England by James I in 1606. In 1607, they left for Virginia, and the Virginia Company Charter stipulated, had a long list of names for them and their children, and to whomsoever they should bind this over to, that they had rights and responsibilities. Okay? The first colony in America is a corporation. In fact, interestingly, when Spain and Portugal colonize the world, they do not create corporations, and they do not do it. In fact, when the Spanish get to America, they find gold, and the Spanish that are here write to the king, and they say, look, we got a great deal here. We got some gold. Don't send anybody else over unless we ask you to. Why? They're a natural state, right? They say, just send us over enough troops to establish control, and we're going to work this out to our maximum advantage. Nobody thinks Virginia's going to do very well. And so what the Virginia colonists say is, we want a corporate charter which makes the king responsible for defending us. And the king says, great, here's your charter. I'll come succor you in your need. I promise to do that. And here's how you're set up. Here's how you will own land. Here's how you'll vote. Here's how you'll select a government. It lays it out. And there's going to be a Commonwealth of Massachusetts charter issued. There's the Hudson Bay Company charter, which is still in operation in Canada. Guess which other countries will do this? The French and the Dutch. Okay, they will colonize the world by corporation. The Dutch East Indies Company will at one point be the largest corporation in the world. Okay? They will use corporate forms. These are pure natural state mechanisms. These are a way of designating just these five people get to own the North American continent. I live in Maryland. Okay, Maryland was created in 1637. Calvert Lord Baltimore was a Catholic. There were some things going on, so he wanted to start a Catholic colony. Guess what the king did? I'm sorry, guys. We're going to take Maryland away from you, and we're going to give it to Rick. They gave Maryland to one guy. One guy. One guy. Okay? Our nation's capital is located on land that the king, Charles the First, before he lost his head, gave to one guy. Okay, and they wrote it down in a charter. They said, here are your rights. And man, those were real privileges. You get a whole state. New York was given to James, Duke of York, who at that time was the younger brother of Charles II. James later became king and then was deposed or abdicated, depending on which way you want the story. So that they were creating corporations. Okay, when we get to 1800, when we get to 1900, who are going to be the four richest countries in the world? British, the Dutch, the French, and the Americans. Okay. So the first four countries to begin to charter these corporations, to begin to create mechanisms for ownership and social support for third-party contractual organizations in a very formal way, turn out, incidentally, to be the first countries to get modern economic development. Okay. Now, what happens when we give you guys this charter to go get Virginia and we let you sell shares? We're talking about this today. What happens when the ELCA decides that it wants to influence corporations? Should it sell shares in the company that it owns? Should it buy shares and try to get on a stockholder meeting? Well, Paul wants to go to Virginia and he's willing to pay. This Paul may be willing to sell. In a natural state, if he's not part of the Ron John coalition, can he get in? But Paul, he really needs the money bad. He still wishes his sister had married the guy who drove the beer truck. So he would dearly like to sell his stock, and in fact, all of you, in some sense, have an immediate interest in allowing that to happen. If the political system is being held together by limited entry, that is potentially dangerous, right? So you've got to have a good natural state, and for this to be able to work, you have to have a fairly stable arrangement historically. Okay? We can't say England in 1561 is stable. It's going to undergo an entire century of revolution over the next, I didn't really say that, right? Between 1560 and 1800, it's going to go through a long period of revolution and internal change about that, okay? But part of that revolution is going to be about entry. I'm a Puritan, and I want to worship as I please, and I'd like to be able to hold office in the government, can't I? Oh, no, I would like to be Catholic. No, I would like to be able to vote for Parliament. No, I don't want John Beck to run my life. In fact, these guys said, you know, the only reason we appointed you in the first place was to protect our rights, and now you want to change our rights. We're going to get rid of you. We're going to cut your head off. Okay, now, in a natural state world, in a real original Ron John world, that now we're back to anarchy. We're going to have civil war. The whole thing's going to break down. In fact, they have a civil war, but they're beginning to develop these chairs, right? These legal entities. These perpetually lived organizations for governance. So in 1607, the United States is going. We got English colonies here, right? We're not talking about ancient English history. We're talking about our history. And what happens in this revolution in Britain is that they're beginning to talk about how John and Ron are integrated into the dominant coalition. What is the structure of the ruling society in Britain? And they conclude that there is a British constitution, the stamina vita, the blood, the bones of the body politic. And it works because it has three main parts. It's the one, the few, and the many, as Aristotle would say. It has the commons, the lords, and the king, as the British would say. And that those three pieces must be balanced. That the, now, this must sound enormously familiar to you after this week, because the whole point of Ron and John forming this coalition was for the rents, the economic interests that we created for them, balanced off their willingness to fight, right? That we had balanced economic and political interests. That was the thing. I'll talk a little bit tomorrow about Machiavelli, Harrington, Hobbes, Locke, Madison, Hamilton, you name it. Western political theory develops a theory of balance, that if powers are balanced, we can maintain stability, and if we cannot, tyranny and slavery will follow. They debated this issue intensely in the 17th century in Britain, and because they were debating it intensely in Britain, people in America were also debating it, because they were British. Right? They were intensely worried about, in fact, when there's the revolution and Cromwell and the Puritans take over, the people in Virginia have not gotten the news until Cromwell's ships show up. And they say, who are you for? And they say, we're for the king. Oh, you know, and then the guns come up. They go, oh, we made a mistake, didn't we? No, you know, we really aren't for the king. Sorry. You know, they didn't know. They had to be on sides. They had to do stuff. They weren't really sure where they should come out on this. So they're intensely watching this debate about the Constitution. In Britain, this becomes known as the Whig political theory. There's going to be a Whig political party that develops in the 18th century, but it's Commonwealth theory. There's a wonderful book by a woman named Caroline Robbins about the Commonwealth men, which is how these ideas about balanced government appear. Now, what's going to happen in Britain between 1700 and 1800, after James II abdicates and William and Mary come in, good Protestant, good Orange, Dutch stock, is that Britain is going to engage in roughly 100 years of warfare with France. It will end in 1815 with the Napoleonic Wars. And the size of government in Britain is going to go from 5% of GDP to 20%. And it's all military and financial development. The British government's going to borrow millions, hundreds of millions of pounds from people to build a navy and an army. And guess what? It's going to pay back every dime. Okay? France is going to borrow tens of millions of livres to fight the British, and they're going to default all the time, which is going to give the British a tremendous advantage. Who's going to sell the stock? Who's going to pay the debt off? Okay, what's tonight's theme? Corporations. I'm with you always. Corporations are with us all. The British will establish the Bank of England to sell bonds and to make interest payments. And here's what they do. They say, we're going to pay back the bonds. How are we going to promise you? The tax revenues, which are mostly on beer, that's their single largest source of revenue, the tax revenues will not be deposited at the Treasury. They will be deposited at the Bank of England. And the Bank of England will make sure the bondholders get paid first, right? And then the rest of the money will ship over to the Exchequer. Now, this is the corporation. It actually is a private corporation. The government doesn't own any stock in it. And of course, the Bank of England loves this because all this money is coming in every day from the tax collectors. So the corporations in England form, because you can buy and sell their assets, stock jobbing will come about. There'll be stock brokers, and there'll be corporations chartered to trade in finance and insurance. They'll be the first kind of corporations. And the king in Parliament is going to get bigger. The king is going to become more powerful. And what the Whigs will say in Britain, and here's where we start with corporations, is that our system works because we have three balanced pieces. We have the House of Commons, we have the House of Lords, and we have the King. The King is hereditary, the House of Lords is hereditary, and the House of Commons is elected by a very small electorate. But if these pieces are balanced, which means they have to be separate, our rights will be protected. Not everybody's Englishman's rights, but our rights as members of the dominant coalition will be protected. The aristocrats will have their land. The King under William and Mary, grants Parliament the right to levy taxes. So when the kings want to fight France, who has to raise the money for them? The Parliament. And as a result, the king says, I've got to have these guys in Parliament on my side. So by the middle of the 18th century, half of the people in the Parliament are either army officers or navy officers, who pay depends directly on the king. They're what are called placemen or pensioners. They're people who have offices in the royal government, or the king has promised them a pension for the remainder of their life. They own stock in the Bank of England. They own stock in other government organizations. The king, in fact, the prime minister's name is Robin Walpole, builds a political coalition in the House of Commons to support the king's policies, and people are saying, this is the corporate economic interests being manipulated by the king and his ministers to get control of the House of Commons. And if the king gets control of the House of Commons, we will lose balance and tyranny and slavery will inevitably follow. We're going to go back to the Ron John world where we don't have any rights. Why does America revolt?
Taxation
without representation is certainly an issue. There's a wonderful book by a guy named Bernard Balin, a historian at Harvard, called The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution. When Balin was a graduate student in the 1950s, he was asked as a research project to gather all the pamphlets of the American Revolution. And only one volume of it was ever published. And these pamphlets, when you read them, sound really crazy today. They say, you know what's happening? They're going to tax us. And if we let them do this, we're going to become enslaved. We're going to become enslaved to Britain. And the reason they thought they were going to become enslaved was because Britain was violating its constitution. These corporations were, in fact, unbalancing the constitution, that the use of economic power to control the polity was out of control in Britain. Now, when financial historians go back and read 18th century British history, they think of this as the flowering of the modern economy, because Britain was, in fact, inventing corporate law and a securities market and a market for government debt that are with us today and are enormously important to our society. But people were really, really, really worried about these corporations because they possessed power that they were using to corrupt the government. Sound familiar? Now, we know looking back that that's not what was happening. Okay? But it didn't matter because this hadn't ever happened before. Okay? What was happening in Britain in the 18th century was something that the world hadn't seen. And it was happening in the United States too because we were British. And fears that the British were being corrupt, Micah writes
in chapter 6 that Ron read this morning, Can I tolerate wicked scales and a bag of dishonest weights in commerce? Your wealthy are full of violence. Ron says, why didn't they say the poor? Right? Well, in a natural state, who's violent? The wealthy. They're the dangerous guys. They're Ron and John. Your inhabitants speak lies, your tongues of deceit, they're with tongues of deceit in their mouth. And then he goes on in chapter 7 to talk about government. Their hands are skilled to do evil. The official and the judge ask for a bribe. And the powerful dictate what they desire. Thus they pervert justice. They are corrupt. The king is called to serve his people. If he does not, he is corrupt. The British Constitution was being corrupted, not by officials who were using their office for private gain, but because the Constitution was being corrupted by the use of economic influence to get political influence. That's what Americans truly feared about what was going on in Britain. And Palin said, you know, when you read these guys talking, they're worried about tyranny and slavery, which sounds totally stupid to us. These guys knew what slavery was like. They owned slaves. How could they be worried that they were going to be enslaved? And what they feared was they were going to lose their rights. Okay. And people in America, lots of people in America owned land because it was cheap. Right? And America was a different place than Britain with the same voting standards. Lots of people in America could vote. And they were worried that those rights were going to be threatened. They could look at Spain. They could look at France. They could see places that did not have well-protected rules of law, or at least think of them that way. And so they revolted. You know, if you think of a firebrand in 1770 saying, you know, if we don't stop this taxation stuff, the British, they're going to take over our governments. They're going to put soldiers in our houses. Right? Well, no, that could never happen. And then it did. The British did it. People started believing maybe this tyranny and slavery stuff was right. So when they get to the revolution, the first thing they want is balanced government. Today we call this checks and balances in our national constitution. But they didn't have a hereditary aristocracy. They didn't have a king. Right? So they started fiddling around with forms of government called constitutions, which are written documents that say, here's how we're going to structure government. They are charters of government. In fact, Connecticut and Rhode Island, who'd gotten a charter from the king in the 1600s, because when the religious, when the people from Massachusetts came over in the name of religious freedom, they established a theocracy, in which if you didn't worship their way, you were out. Okay. Well, we can talk about details. But in fact, owning land was passed out by communities, and the most important person in passing out land was the pastor of the local church. And if you weren't a member in an upstanding local church, you might get a couple acres of scrub land. So Rhode Island and Connecticut, the religious dissidents left, and they got a constitution from the king, which was a new charter, saying, here, you're the plantation of Rhode Island. They actually kept their, they just, what they did when they revolted is they scratched out the name of the king and wrote in the Commonwealth of Rhode Island. They kept their constitution. That was good enough for them. Everybody else wrote new ones, okay, in which they had a balance of power. They didn't all have the federal constitutional structure. In fact, the first federal constitution fails. It's called the Articles of Confederation. You know, we're working on version 2 now, not version 1, although we call the version we have the Constitution in capital letters. Actually, we had, by that time, we already had 14 state constitutions. Pennsylvania had, had 2. And they were working these problems out. Okay? So they create self-constituting governments with balance. And what's the thing they're really, really worried about? Faction. They're concerned that one group in the population is going to get control of the political system by getting enough votes, that a demagogue will come up, like Chavez in Venezuela, and will convince half of the population to vote for them. And of course, half the population is, you know, includes a lot of relatively small, poorly educated people who John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington maybe don't trust so much. Okay? And they're really worried that they'll sell their votes. They're not really worried that they'll vote for social welfare policies. They're worried that they'll sell their votes to a rich guy. Now, the other thing they want, however, is economic development. And how do you get economic development? Corporations. How'd you develop Virginia? You created a corporation. You want to build a bridge over the Charles River? What you do is you give a charter to these six people. And you let them have a monopoly on the tolls. You let them keep the money. They build the bridge. It pays for itself. Taxes don't go up. Right? We get what we want. Americans start chartering banks. They start chartering turnpike companies. They start chartering bridges. In order, they're using the corporate mechanism as a way to promote economic development, as a way to not promote private economic development, but to promote social ends. And this is something that they know because they can see what France has done, and they can see what Britain has done, and they can see what Holland has done, and what they have done. They know that in order to harness the organizational power and the energy of their citizens, they need to use the corporate form. They need to promise this group that they can be held together, that they could make commitments that they will honor and that the society will honor. At the same time, they are dramatically afraid that if they create a corporation, it will use its economic power to take over the political system.
So when Ford and Dodge lined up in 1919, what impact does that have on this environment that has been created? Or is that jumping too far?
That's jumping too far. Because Ford and Dodge doing that thing is going to be in the context of a set of laws which won't really emerge until the 1890s. In that, I don't know, I'm going to check my watch here. Okay, good. We're not doing too bad. How many political parties were there after the revolution? Does anybody know?
One.
Who was president?
George
Washington, by acclamation, practically. One of the reasons that they wrote the second national constitution was because the federal government was bankrupt. It owed about $50 million and it wasn't paying interest on its debts except to a few Dutch bankers because it wanted to borrow more money from them. States had another $25 million in debt. And so one of the reasons to write the Constitution was to give the national government the power to levy taxes, which it didn't have under the Articles of Confederation. And so the first thing they did when Congress gets together in the very first session is they're trying to figure out a way to pay off the debts. And Alexander Hamilton is the first Secretary of the Treasury under Washington. He comes forward with a plan for the public credit, and it involves creating a bank. And guess who the bank is modeled after? The Bank of England. And there's a big debate, and it passes through Congress, and George Washington is supposed to sign the bank bill, and George says, you know what, am I supposed to do this? And so he asked Thomas Jefferson and Edmund Randolph and Alexander Hamilton to write letters giving him advice on whether you should charter or not. And Hamilton says, of course you should charter this. You know, if we don't create functional groups within our society that can provide these services, we won't get the services. And Jefferson says, are you really sure you want to do this? You know, this is going to be a really powerful group. Should the government be in the business of creating factions? And Washington actually goes with Hamilton. He charters the bank. And then within a year, Jefferson and James Madison say, you know what? This is a corruption of the Constitution. What we've just allowed Alexander Hamilton and George Washington to do is to create a bank and to sell shares and to allow that economic concentration of power to potentially influence our political system. And they go nuts. I mean, they go really crazy politically. And they form the Republican Party. Adams will get elected as a Federalist in 1896, and Jefferson will be elected as the Republican vice president because he gets the second most amount of votes. And poor John Adams has his opponent as vice president. So Adams and Jefferson will run again in 1800, and the election is going to go to the House of Representatives. And guess who gets to count the votes? The vice president, who is president pro tem of the Senate. So Jefferson counts the votes. Turns out there's some disputed votes from Georgia that might have not thrown the election to Adams, but would have thrown it back into a five-man race instead of a two-man race. And Jefferson says, oh, no, these votes are okay. I'm sorry, that was a digression I needed to have. Jefferson and Adams go right after the Federalists. And the main purpose is they have a corporation. Okay, that Alexander Hamilton was trying to be Robin Walpole. Now, this is not corruption that's venal. This is not the bribes and stuff that Steve's been talking about. This is what I call systematic corruption. This is a corruption of the Constitution. Now, America wants banks because they want to trade goods over long distances, and banks are necessary to finance that. They want canals. They want roads. They want bridges. Okay, and they know that they can't provide those through private action, and so they begin to charter corporations. And by the time we get to 1830, there will be 600 chartered banks in the United States. One of them chartered by the national government, and 599 plus chartered by the state governments. There will be hundreds of manufacturing companies, thousands of manufacturing companies. There will be bridge companies, railroad companies, canal companies, all over the place. They will begin to worry about how to do this because a corporation is an act of the sovereign, it requires an act of the state legislature. And what does that require? Politics. Right? If you want a corporate charter, you've got to go lobby the legislature to get it for you. So you might pay some people off. Does that ever happen? Yes. So this is called special incorporation because it takes that act of the legislature. The alternative is general incorporation, which is creating corporations by a general law, which make them available to everybody. The first General Incorporation Act is passed in the world, in the entire world, history, human history as far as we know, is passed by the state of New York in 1790. And you know what it incorporates? Churches. The colony of New York, where Ron Vignette was born, has religious freedom.
But it turns out in the colonial period that only two kinds of churches can get corporate charters, Dutch Reformed and Anglican. And if you're a church and you don't have a charter, when you go to borrow money, you're a partnership, and everybody in the congregation is liable for the debt. If you're a rich guy, nobody wants to do this, right? If you are not a corporation, you cannot receive bequests in wills because you are not an identity, right? Only people can receive bequests. So the first General Incorporation Act that allows everybody to get a charter is in fact a Corporation Act for churches. It says we're going to allow every religious group in the state of New York that wants to enter and compete in the religious realm to have a charter. Massachusetts will pass what amounts to general incorporation for banks in a slightly different way in 1815. New York famously will pass the Free Banking Act, which allows anybody to get a banking charter who has a $50,000. So we're not talking easy entry there in 1837. In the 1830s, there's an enormous economic boom. There's a land boom. More land is sold to private individuals out of the public domain in 1836 than any other year in the nation's history, 25 million acres. What are we sitting on right now? The public domain. In 1899, you could have come to the federal land office and bought this land. Under Teddy Roosevelt, they decided to stop selling land, so you can't. Can the state of Washington? No, never. I don't want to go there. The state of Washington can't regulate this land because it's not in Washington. It's not the property of the state of Washington. It's the property of the national government, which creates some real issues. In Steve's issue, I talked about Indiana. In 1836, Indiana borrowed $10 million, 5% bonds, to finance a canal investment scheme. At this point, there were 500,000 people living in Indiana, and the state budget was $50,000. So this is like having an income of $50,000 and going out and putting $10 million on your MasterCard. Okay? And lots of things happened, and they went bankrupt. On January 1st, 1841, the state of Indiana declared itself in default on its debts. Later on in the month, Mississippi went bankrupt. And Mississippi, to add insult to injury, in 1842 repudiated the debt and said, we'll never pay it back. Arkansas went into bankruptcy. There's still a clause in the Arkansas Constitution that says the state will never pay back the Holford bonds, which were bonds that were transferred to some guy in London. They were worried sick. They were going through a third world default crisis. They were going through like what Argentina went through a couple years ago, you know, when they gave all their bond holders a haircut. That is, they wrote down the value of their debt by about 60%. We were really worried about that, and we could see that our political system was responsive to corporations and came forward and said, give us a charter for a canal and we'll build you a canal. Right? Borrow money, give it to us, and you'll never have to pay it back. That's how the Mississippi Union Bank was chartered, the one that went. Ellen gave me a defaulted Mississippi, repudiated Mississippi Union Bank bond for Christmas one year. I have it in my bedroom. I look at it every night to remind me of this. How could we stop this from happening? Well, we could say, don't borrow money anymore, right? And we could say, don't build any more canals. But if we did that, what were you condemning Indiana to? They were going to be out in the middle of nowhere for the rest of time. People out there wanted roads and canals. So here was their solution, and it was incredibly insightful. They said, let's give everybody who wants a corporate charter a charter. Let's have general incorporation acts. In fact, many states, between 1842 and 1852, 12 states rewrote their constitutions. 8 of them made general incorporation mandatory. And they did it explicitly for political reasons, not for economic reasons. They did it saying that we need to take bidding in the political process for corporate privileges off the table. We do not want to get rid of corporations because we still know that empowering us as groups of individuals to do things is a good thing. But if we empower one particular group and give them privilege, they are in fact going to unravel the democratic process. At the same time they passed If you want to borrow money, you have to raise taxes before you borrow it. And how many of you voted in the school bond referendum? That's when that happened, the 1840s. 11 of the 12 states that wrote new constitutions adopted bond referendum for authorizing debt. Now, notice what's happened here. The United States may or may not, I don't know what it is in the colonial period. I don't know whether it's a Ron John society. I don't know if it's a natural state. I don't know whether it's open access. I'm not sure what's going on. And we could debate about that. But decisively, in the early 19th century, when the Americans adopted democratic institutions, they didn't know whether they were going to work or not. Right? They had adopted the possibility of a competitive economy. Of a competitive polity. In fact, Americans opened up entry into the political process way before they opened up entry into the economic process. Okay? So they had competitive politics. We believed that that would work because it was embodied in a balanced constitution. And we immediately began worrying that concentrated economic power would lead the hands of our officials to be skilled to do evil. The official and the judge ask for a bribe, the powerful dictate what they desire, thus they pervert justice. How did we solve that? We did not solve it by electing moral and ethical people to office. We know that, right? You can't. Because we can't make saints out of sinners. We can't. Maybe God can, but we can't. We live in a world where we don't have that power. How can we constrain them? How can we get open political competition, which will do part because it will give us a chance to vote? How can we make sure that concentrated economic power doesn't undo that? Is that something we're all afraid of? Yes. Amen. Corporations are
evil.
Because they're concentrated economic power that has disproportionate influence in politics. Okay? We all believe that happens all the time, right? Campaign finance reform is to get the big corporations out of politics. Every time they write it, the politicians figure out a way to get around it. How did we solve the problem of systematic corruption? By opening economic entry. By giving everybody a corporate charter. By not creating a privileged Bank of England, which was the only people that had the right to issue banknotes within 90 miles of London. A famous case was the Charles River Bridge Company. The state of Massachusetts gave Harvard University and other stockholders a monopoly on building bridges across the Charles. Somebody else wanted to build a bridge. They sued the state of Massachusetts, said, you gave us a monopoly. Daniel Webster argued for the state for the bridge company. And the Supreme Court said, you know, state can't give away the public good. There's got to be competition. Okay. Now, we embody that in an individualistic way, in an ideology. What Jeff has been talking about partly this week is the discourse of competition. That's how we think of ourselves as individuals. But how do we compete? We compete as organizations. How are we going to exercise our power to change these corporations? Through the ELCA, through coordinated effort. What happens in early 19th century America happens to churches, it happens to library societies, it happens to firehouses and protection societies. And it happens to business corporations. Our society decides collectively to put more tools in our hands to form sophisticated organizations. And then we allow our society to work because competition between those organizations is going to provide the balance that we need. Yep.
One of the things that I've learned about corporate law is that at some point, I think during the 1800s, that corporations receive rights the same as individuals.
Yes.
And that does not make corporations evil, but it allows them to have a great power over human rights issues in some cases. And I'm wondering if that has something to do with this. Because when you're talking about competition, if a corporation has the same rights as I do, it makes for a dicey situation when a corporation is a lot of people with a lot of money and I am.
Yeah. Okay. This is called the issue of corporate personality. And I'll give you a brief answer to that. In law, up until really the beginning of the 19th century, people largely possessed rights not as individuals, but as members of an organization. So in British and French law, if you were the earl, you had a lot more rights than if you were the baron, than if you were a peasant, right? Then if you were a villain, if you were a tenant, you were way down the line. So you're, where you stood at law was defined within the organization. What happens when you become a citizen? Oh, now your rights adhere to you as an individual, right? So how do we balance off individual rights with corporate, with organizational rights? Okay? And so what happened was is that organizations initially possessed lots of rights as organizations. And when we gave the charters, we gave them certain rights. And then the question became, well, are corporations individuals or not? Do they have extra powers or not? And so what eventually evolved was the idea that corporations are individuals. They are individuals at law. They can sue and be sued. They can be held accountable and all that sort of thing. And what that did, really, was to put organizations, corporations, on exactly the same footing before the law as people. What was happening is we were empowering individuals through the law, and we created an equality of power with individuals and corporations as opposed to privileging the corporations. Okay? Now, corporations still had certain things because they were organizations that individuals could not possess because individuals don't have that same kind of internal organization. But in fact, the intent there was to equate them at law.
But isn't one of the effects of that that if a corporation does something that diminishes profit, they can be sued?
Oh, they could have been sued before. That didn't do that. The difference was is that by making corporations people, they're fictional personalities, okay? Then you make them subject to exactly the same laws as a person is, right? Whereas if they're not a person, then they have a charter which stipulates their privileges, their rights and responsibilities in a different kind of way, okay? So you could sue, you could always sue them unless the charter said you couldn't sue them, but that never happened, okay? So why is this important? Are we all the same in before the law? Yeah, realistically, we are. We can buy lawyers and do stuff like that, you know? And believe me, we may not believe in the United States that we're all completely equal, but we're way more equal than we would be in Argentina. Okay? And we want corporations to be equal before the law in the same kind of way. So we don't want them having special privileges hidden in their charters, which we don't know about until we get them to court. And so making them persons is just like this general incorporation process, is making them just a citizen like everybody else. Now, they're powerful citizens, and we may want to regulate them through specific kinds of things. And we do, right? We do. Yeah.
I don't know anything about corporate law, but am I mistaken now that in the last maybe decade or maybe longer, corporations now are more powerful than nation states, and that if push comes to shove, the state loses?
Nope. Obviously, Microsoft is more powerful than Chad. Okay? Right. There are plenty of dysfunctional states that many corporations are much more powerful than. There are corporations probably with as many employees as some. There's 220 countries in the world, and some of them are extremely small. Okay? Is there a corporation in the United States that's more powerful than the United States government? Not even close. Not even close. Right? Is there a corporation in the United States that's more powerful than a state government? Not even close. Not even close. In fact, there's not a corporation chartered in America that isn't the creature of a state. And if the state doesn't like it, your charter's gone, the corporation is dissolved.
Even with environmental laws and
you
things
bet.
Like that.
You bet.
And does the same hold for transnational?
Yep. And now there may be corporations that are chartered outside the United States that have different rules.
However, you've been talking about the potential unbalancing power of economic power, unbalancing the fact of economic power.
Right.
And there are some huge corporations like Microsoft with huge economic power.
That's right.
Which fuzzes.
No. Wait. I will talk about this. What is the balance for the huge economic power? Is it a political power? No. No. It's other economic competitors. Okay? I'll talk about this tomorrow. I promise I will talk about this tomorrow. But the balance is competition. So the balance to Microsoft's economic power is Google. Right? And I know that sounds, that's trivial. Look, my first wife, not Ellen,
drove in a carpool with Bill Gates. He was a nerd, and he had nothing. Okay? He made all this money. Does that make him all powerful? No, 20 years from now, he could be gone. What about AT&T and IT&T? Remember IT&T? You remember it? It's gone. It's gone. It just doesn't exist anymore. It was really powerful. It's gone because of competition. All right, I'm sorry.
My last thought was just you could have competing entities, but they could have the same interests.
Oh, yeah.
And therefore, it overthrows the power of the people also.
Yeah. Okay, so that.
Like Google and Microsoft have the same interests too,
You're absolutely right. Does it happen?
No.
No. Are we rational to be paranoid about it? Yes. We should be. We should be worried that our system is one of balance in which competition provides the balance, right? So we should be worried about sustaining political and economic competition. We should be really worried when Halliburton gets the $5 billion contract in Iran with no bidding. Right? We should be really worried about that. We should be worried that a political faction will manipulate the economy to get them into power. And the solution to that is not the Constitution, it's competition. Right? The Constitution does not prevent a faction from getting control of the federal government. Right? Because they can get people elected. What works is that if one group gets a lot of power, what does everybody else do? They get better organized. They compete. And if they do not get organized and they do not compete, tyranny and slavery will follow.
Then we call them Democrats.
Okay, let's go to Vespers. Thank you.